Welcome back to the Connection Podcast. We're happy to be with you after a couple of weeks hiatus. Today we have an episode that has been requested by several people. We interviewed Susan Oakley of Springfield 4th Ward. We get into a lot of topics that I think will be interesting for many people. A lot of you already know Susan Oakley. You know about her family, their history in the music industry. She also talks about a lot of other just interesting experiences from her life that I think many people will be able to relate to. Thank you again for joining us. I think you'll love this episode, and we'll connect again soon. Welcome to the Connection Podcast. I'm Jason Keister, the show's producer, and it may have felt like a little while because it's been a while. We've had general conference, state conference. I just felt like taking a break, so we've been away for a while, but the Connection Podcast is still going strong. We're at finally over 500 subscribers now, which is cool.
Congratulations.
And nice. A lot more listeners that have chimed in from time to time, so grateful for that. And as a reminder, we are the podcast in the area where members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or members of the community in general connect with other people in their area. And today we have our special guest, Susan Oakley from Springfield 4th Ward.
Yep, that's where we're from.
All right. I like that inquisitive look, 4th Ward, right?
Well, I thought Blue River. No, we're not in Blue River anymore. We're in 4th Ward.
Funny, because, yeah.
And then I was in 5th Ward for years, you know, so it's hard to keep track.
It's interesting, because when you serve in like a bishopric or something, you run in similar circles, and I think we run into each other, but this is our first time really meeting and chatting, so.
Yeah, I think so.
And I won't hype you up too much, but a lot of people have recommended that we contact you for an interview, so.
I can't wait for the questions.
Yeah, a lot of recommendations for sure. And then we have the Gross Nichols with us, who, have you been on the show yet, Yana, or is this your first time?
I have not been on this show before. This is my first longtime listener, first time guest.
Yeah, so welcome. And then Peter Gross Nichols been a guest.
Howdy.
Now he's a guest host, both from Springfield 4th Ward. And then we have Jeff Fuller, who's been here a lot.
I've been here a lot. Yeah. You can't get rid of me.
Welcome back. I don't have any Coke in the fridge today. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I noticed. I'm just kidding.
I didn't even have a diet option. That's pretty lame on my part.
No, it's good. Happy to be here.
So we'll dive right in. So Sue, we start most of our podcast episode with general question. I want you to imagine that you are going into a new ward, and as you typically do, you'll be called to introduce yourself and your family and go.
Okay. Well, my name right now is Susan Oakley. Jim and I have been married. It'll be 20 years in January, which is pretty incredible to me because it seems like yesterday. We have between us 7 children, one of which is active, 6 of which are not. So it is an interesting blend. You know, we love our kids, and he and I both serve at the storehouse, at the Bishop Storehouse on the home storage side as a mission right now. I am supposed to be retired, but I couldn't stand that a whole lot.
Stick.
I missed the kids. And so I found a long-term sub job, and I'm back at the same middle school now through June, which I'm really enjoying. Jim has lived in this area a long time, and I have lived here since 1971, when we moved back from Tennessee. My first husband was in the music business and decided he did not want his children raised in Nashville. So unbeknownst to me, he bought a house. And when I came out to visit my folks, lo and behold, all our belongings were here.
Oh, and so
we've been here since 73. In 1973, in October, he moved us out here. And so we raised our kids pretty much in Blue River. And then we moved to town when I started teaching, and we're in 5th Ward for years. And then we were back on a mission to Blue River. And then now we're back in 4th Ward. So that's where
awesome.
We are.
So you work in the storehouse part of time. So you work with the Eastons. You spend time with them.
We do. Well, we work on Saturdays.
Okay.
The Eastons are in the temple on Saturdays.
Okay.
So what we do is we do demonstrations on Saturdays that highlight the different products in the storehouse.
Okay.
Because a lot of people have storage, but they don't know how to use it. They don't know what they can do with it, or what implements they need on hand to be able to use it effectively. And if everything goes out and the electricity goes, then is that electric wheat grinder going to do you much good? How do you hook up your wheat grinder so you run it with a bicycle and, you know, those kinds of things? And what other dishes and things can you use the products in the storehouse for? So every week.
You got to give a specific plug because Susan teaches these incredible classes every Saturday at 11 a.m. Out at the storehouse, the home storage part.
Okay, let's be careful. It's not class, teaching yeah, class. There you go. It's a demonstration because the county's very strict, you know, with the storehouse about what we can do there and what we can't. We can't cook up a pizza. We can't make candy. We can't. Those would be fun things to do. And Jim and I are available to go out and do those in wards. But there at the storehouse, we have to specifically highlight one of the products. And so we do a lot of research on what it's used for. We'll, for instance, this next week is on planting wheat. A lot of you have wheat. Do you know how to plant it? Do you know what it looks like? Do you know how wheatgrass is good for you? Do you know what the nutritional value of sprouted grains are? Those kinds of things. And then we give that information out and we show what we've done, you know, what we've planted or what, whatever the product is, how we've used it.
Well, and anybody that's learned anything from Sue, it's a pretty awesome experience. And there's, you always get to taste something, right?
Get to like taste something. Well, I didn't have anything for the All Seasons this last Saturday, unfortunately. The white flour,
You didn't want to taste the white flour?
No, if anybody had shown up, because really nobody should be eating white flour anyway. It's not very nutritional, but everybody has white flour. You know, there's ways to use it to enhance. And what we were doing was salt clay dough, so there wasn't anything to taste. No.
just to
making Christmas ornaments.
But I did hear Sister Olson share that there's now dried strawberries there in the home storage section.
There are, yes. Strawberries are now available in the home storage side. They're a little spendy, but they go a long ways. It's $18 a can, I think, which works out to 80-something. A case.
Oh, I thought you were going to say 80 cents a strawberry.
No, no, no.
She has it down.
I don't remember exactly what the price is, you know, for the case, but a case of strawberries would last you a very long time.
Right. But those demonstrations every Saturday?
Every Saturday from 11 to 12.
Yep. Is there a schedule we can get of which
there is, and that schedule's gone out to every Relief Society president in the eight or nine states we serve.
Yeah.
I think so my presidency should be telling us what's going on.
And, you know, communication in the church is kind of laissez-faire.
Yeah.
That's the breakdown. But those are the people, the Relief Society presidents are who I can communicate with. And we're working on that a little harder.
Well, we got a little taste of maybe some need for that during the ice storm. And so, definitely an awesome
mainly
opportunity.
Mainly what we've had in on Saturdays are non-members.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an excellent, excellent way to bring non-members in.
Yeah, bring your neighbors.
It's a very non-threatening, look, you can buy this product. You know, we had some people come in for the zombie apocalypse and buy over $1,000 worth of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so we don't judge. You come in. The product is a little more expensive than what you would find at Walmart or Winco, but it's already canned and it's got a shelf life of 20 to 30 years, which is a big difference. You know, not having to do it.
So the people who come in, who aren't members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, how do they find out about the Bishop's Storehouse? And are they coming in with friends?
They're hearing about it through friends, mainly. Mm. Friends is a couple of weekends ago. A gentleman came in with his wife and his son, and I kept thinking, I know this person. Who is this person? I know them, but I couldn't place him at church. I couldn't figure out where I'd seen him. It turned out, because he asked me a question about a car, because I had called him and talked to him. He was a former student from 30 years ago.
I was going to say.
In the sixth grade at Thurston Middle, a non-member who had heard about the storehouse through Jeremy Esch. And so Jeremy had told him, and Ryan and his wife came in and bought product. And I was like, that is Ryan. I know who that is.
And they didn't say, hi, Mrs. Look the same.
No, he did. He knew me. He goes, hi. I didn't know you worked here. Oh. But I was standing there
trying to connect the
headlight
dots.
Going, who? Oh, church? No, not church. Yeah. Who is this? And then it dawned on me when he asked me about, he said, hey, did you buy that car I talked to you about? I went, it's Ryan.
Right.
No, I did not buy that car, but now I know who you are.
Well, if you hear about a certain bishop and his friend Kirk doing shenanigans in the Bishop's Storehouse, it wasn't me.
It was a different bishop.
But if I did, maybe we turned a bunch of stuff upside down in the grocery side Yeah. I know.
Cindy Easton was on you about that.
Well, I asked specifically when we did our tour. I was like, "Where does Cindy sit, and what can she see?" So we might have.
This is why they don't have Easton's volunteers.
The Eastons run that place like a temple. It's amazing. Yeah,
they do, and actually, it's pretty cool to do a tour. We did one with the young men, and the information they give you is great, and they do talk a lot about how they treat it like a temple, and the amount of respect they give to that place is neat.
Yeah, it's awesome to have one here just in our stake.
Anna is our daughter's sister, Gross Nickel, serving her service mission here, and she's been working in the Bishop Storehouse once a week, and she says it's like, she's like, "Mom, why is it a place where I can feel the spirit so strongly? Like, what makes it a spiritual place?"
Yeah.
And we talked about how it's a place of order, and that's
it's dedicated.
Yep. And a place of service. But she loves serving there.
Yeah, it's a place where you're like, the true gospel of Jesus Christ is definitely in effect.
Especially when you're helping those people who are coming in, and they feel a little defensive anyway, and you make them feel at home, and everything is accessible, and all their questions are answered.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Thank you for your service there.
Absolutely. So let's start going around. We'll go this direction. Not like anybody listening can tell which way I'm pointing, but let's start with Jeff, and then we'll just keep asking questions around the room.
All right. I have a lot of questions that aren't on these papers, but I want to start with one of these stories that you mentioned. It says, "The time my great-grandmother killed her rooster to get her seeds back." And I ask this for a couple of reasons. First off, Susan, we have like a chicken connection. My first chickens that we ever had at our house came from Sue.
Yep.
And then we also gave them back to you when they stopped laying.
That's fine.
Because I couldn't get rid of them myself.
They lived a happy little life.
That's right.
One of them is still alive. The other one passed. One of them is.
Anyway, so let's hear about your great grandmother and this rooster.
Okay. Well, I am sixth generation LDS. Mm-hmm. And so my great, 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 great grandfather.
That might be as far back as you can be. How many generations can that be?
Job joined the church in 1831, I believe.
Oh, okay.
John Taylor was the one that baptized their family in upstate New York. And then his son, John Pack, bought the farm from his father, and his father went on to Kirtland right away. I mean, very early. And so when this all came out and John Pack went west in the first company, in fact, he was one of the buffalo hunters and one of the leaders, you know, that took over when Brigham got sick as they moved into Immigration Canyon. Well, he went back in October and he got his wives who were in far west and brought them out, and they had very little time to plant because they got there in the spring, the next spring.
Yeah.
And they had very few supplies. And so she went out, this grandmother went out, and she planted her garden and went back in the cabin and looked out the window. And this rooster was walking down the aisle, picking all the seeds out of the ground. And she said, "That's it." And she went out and she slaughtered the rooster and slit his craw open and took all the seeds out and went back out and put all those seeds back in the ground. And they had chicken dumplings that night.
Rooster and dumplings.
Rooster should not have eaten her seeds. But that was the kind of, you know, stick-to-itiveness they had. She knew that that was her family's food.
Right.
And so that rooster wasn't sticking around.
I love it.
Yeah. Awesome. And I love stories like that. You know, when you read about the sacrifices that these people made so that we have the gospel, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. That is incredible. That's great. Thank you.
You've talked about living in and serving within the Blue River branch.
Mm-hmm.
Can you compare maybe your first impressions landing there to the feelings you had serving maybe your last month there, and how it changed in your eyes, and some lessons you've learned from serving and living in a smaller unit of the church?
We first moved to Blue River in 73 when Mickey moved us out here, because he bought a house up the McKenzie next near my parents.
I like how you said that, when Mickey moved us out here.
Yeah, when Mickey moved us out here. Yeah, I had no idea. I had no idea. He decided, "We're not raising the kids in Nashville. We're going west." And you know, that's a whole story in itself. Blue River, at that time, we were meeting in the logging camp across the Fen Rock, across that creek.
Oh,
all right. And it was a very, it was nice. It was a church. They had built the church in the camp, and the owner of the logging mill, of the logging camp, used to go around on Sunday mornings and knock on everybody's door, and they'd all go to church.
Wow.
Well, that was clear back in the 30s and 40s. By the time the 70s rolled around, nobody was going to church in the logging camp. In fact, nobody even lived in the logging camp. And the church leased the church. And the Blue River branch had started out in the Westover's home in Cedar Flats. Then it had moved to the Hiddleston's place in Blue River. And there were probably maybe five or six couples. And then it had moved to my parents' living room for a while on Lee Shore Drive for, and then it got too big. There were, you know, they had too many people coming, so they rented the logging camp. So when Mickey and I moved in, it was a very cold building. You had to start oil furnace, and maybe it would heat up by the end of sacrament meeting, maybe not. The pews were very rough. We were very careful because you got splinters in your rear end all the time. Mm. You know, the kids would. The bathrooms were outdoors.
Too much.
And so if the kids had to go to the bathroom, you had, you know, sometimes they'd come screaming back in because there were spiders. It was very primitive, but it was, there was a great feeling, you know. My parents were members of the branch. My brother and sister were members of the branch. My sister and her husband were members of the branch. We had a lot of kids up there. And then the Browns were there and Fries were there. And in the midst of that, the Eshes moved in. So we had a pretty good sized primary up there. We probably had 16 to 20 kids
in primary.
It was very active and very vocal and very warm. And the Grants, Amy and Bill Grant, Bill was the branch president at the, well, it wasn't, I'm not even sure he was a branch president at that time. It might have been a mission. But somewhere in there, he became a branch president.
Okay.
And then after we'd been there for about 5 years, the church built the branch, the building that's there now, which was so luxurious compared to what we'd been in. It was amazing. But it also hurt a little bit to leave the old building because there were so many good memories there.
Yeah.
You know, we were still in that building when I had my third child, Stephen, because I was primary president. And I moved a piano. And I shouldn't have. Uh-oh. And the next day I went into labor. That night I went into labor and had him 7 weeks early.
Oh,
so wow. That was in 82. So we were still there in 82. And I think by 85, we had the new building somewhere around there. But the feeling, it was different because there were more kids, you know, in those first days. Mm-hmm. When Jim and I left the branch after this mission, the Acevedo kids were there. And the Patton kids are there, but that's about it. So primary is very small now.
Yeah.
We used to have to, we had primary in the chapel. And the auxiliaries had to go to the other rooms because we had way more kids.
More kids, yeah.
So that's probably the biggest difference. But the spirit up there has always been really strong and the same. I can't say that it's always been bittersweet to leave there. Because they just, everybody looks out for everybody else.
I was going to say, what things did you learn from the members in Blue River over your time in service there?
Well, we had a sister, Kuiman, who was Barbara Zietz's mother, who had come to Oregon in a covered wagon.
Wow.
And, you know, she taught us to make soap. She taught us how to do all sorts of pioneer things. And I remember in one Relief Society meeting, we had work meetings at that time. I was going to do this quilt, and I was going to do it all by hand, and I was going to sew it by hand. And I was so proud of the fact that I was going to take on this project. And Sister Kuyamim, who was probably close to 90 then, leaned over and she said, "Sister Newbury, if your pioneer grandmother had a sewing machine, do you think she would have used it?" I was like,
that's a great lesson.
We didn't do those things because we wanted to. We did them because we had to.
Yeah, that's great.
Very cute. Well, if there's one thing too that you could share with us, maybe those of us who have never served in a smaller unit, what's something you could share that you've gained from that's maybe a feeling or experience that I wouldn't learn because I haven't served in a smaller unit of the church like that?
Well, I served in an even smaller unit than Blue River. When Mickey and I first got married, we were living in Nashville. There was no, it was a mission. There wasn't even a branch in Nashville. Now there's a temple. You know, there was nothing. And I honestly didn't think the church would ever thrive in Nashville, to be perfectly honest. I mean, that's how little I knew. But I was in the primary presidency, and we had to drive to Bowling Green, Kentucky, and Chattanooga. I mean, it was the entire mission that you had to go serve. So one of the things I think you learn in a smaller unit is that everybody pitches in and you all do the work. There's no such thing as this is just your job. I remember whining one time to a friend in Eugene, first ward or third ward. I don't remember which bishopric John was in. And, you know, I have seven jobs in the branch. This is just not fair. I don't know what I'm going to do. I have seven jobs. And he said, listen, I am second counselor and I go out to people extending callings and they tell me no. He said, the same percentage of a big ward runs the ward just like in a branch. So stop your whining because we all have to pitch it. And we're going, oh, okay. All right, I'll stop whining now. But, you know, I don't think the size of the unit matters, but in a smaller unit, you have to do more. You have to rely on each other more. And if somebody doesn't show up to play the organ, then you have to play the piano. Or if somebody doesn't show up to teach primary, you find a way to do that because you have very limited resources. In a larger ward, we tend to get apathetic. You know, oh, somebody will pick that up. I don't have to.
Thank you.
So you talked about having to travel when you lived in Nashville to go to church. So when you lived there, and you said your husband, Mickey, like moved you out here because he didn't want to raise his kids there, how did you keep a gospel perspective? How did you keep that spirit alive while you were there and involved in the music industry?
We lived on a houseboat, and we fed the elders every Friday night, but we had to get special permission from the mission president to do that because it was a boat. Missionaries were not allowed on a boat because water, you know, I mean, it was a serious concern. And like, so the mission president
was like, water is the devil or something.
Exactly. Oh, well, you know, in scriptures and Dr. Cummins talks about how Satan, you know, can control the waters. And the mission president came out and he made sure that, you know, this wasn't a den of iniquity and that it was, we had a picture of Christ on the wall, you know.
Gambling riverboat.
Yeah, exactly. It was a gambling riverboat. And so I think that probably, that had a lot to do with it. And we did have it wasn't a branch. I don't even remember what we called it. It was just a unit. We met in Nashville in a drugstore, in the back of a drugstore. But they also leased that out on Saturday nights to some kind of a club. So we would have to go in and sweep up the cigarette butts and open the windows and clean the benches off because that's where we had church the night before. Everybody was partying. So, you know, we had good, strong members. You know, there were Judy Martin and her husband. He was a songwriter. I'm trying to remember. There was another Walker.
I don't know how you keep track of anyone with all the people that you know.
Too many years ago, he was a big country music artist. He, you know, they attended. So there were people in the business that were also members, but they were few and far between.
How did you and Mickey meet?
And how long were you together before you got married?
I knew that question was going to come up. I was in the New Christie Minstrels with Kenny Rogers, and Kenny and Mickey had grown up together in Houston. They had both been in doo-wop groups in high school. That was the big rage in the 50s. Every high school had their own.
Why wouldn't Kenny Rogers be in a doo-wop group?
That's how he started. That's how he started in the business. Then he went to a jazz group, and then he went to the Christies. So I toured with the Christies for a year, almost 2 years. And Kenny, we had been together. That group had been together longer than almost the original part of the Christies. We threatened to hold reunions in Shea Stadium because they've had so many people in the group. But it's kind of like where you got your credentials, you know.
Where you started.
You earned your stripes in this group, and they traveled every single day. We were in Nashville. And Kenny, we were getting ready to do a recording session, and Kenny kept saying, I got this friend that's a songwriter in Nashville. We need to do some of his songs because he's an up-and-coming writer, and he's really struggling, and we just need to record one of his songs. And so Mickey came. We were playing at Vanderbilt University, and I remember it was in, because we were in the locker rooms, and Mickey came in, and I met him there, and we talked for a little bit. Well, it turned out Mickey didn't need the Christie's help. He had the number one country, the number one rhythm and blues, the number one soul, and the number one easy listening, all by different artists. Hmm. Ray Charles, Andy, what was his name? The big easy listening, Andy. Well, whatever. But he had four different artists, you know, number one.
Singing his songs.
Yeah, singing his songs. And he didn't need our help. I don't know what Kenny was thinking about. So
he was trying to get you guys to meet.
Yeah, I guess. You know? So we met then and talked a little bit. And not long after that, I was in Los Angeles and Kenny set up a blind date between us. And we went out to see Space Odyssey 2001.
Didn't say three words to each other
the whole night. We had both just kind of broken up with people and it was like, whatever. And I didn't see him for 2 years. And then by that time I'd left the Christie's and I was nannying for Kenny and Margo before I came back to the University of Oregon to go to school. Cause I was just done with the road. I said, this is not the way I want to spend my life. I just need to go back to school. But I had the summer, so I stayed with Kenny and Margo, and I took care of their kids while Margo went to school. And Mickey showed up with Chris Christopherson, and it was like we sat and talked for about 2 or 3 hours, and it was like I was talking to my best friend. And I was like, this is just weird. In fact, it spooked me. And I got in the car, and I left that night and drove back home to Oregon. My dad had had surgery. And I just used it as an excuse. I said, I'm out of here. I want a career. I want to go back to school. I don't need any kind of emotional entanglement. I'm leaving. And so I went back home. Well, Mickey had been there writing the Johnny Hartford show and also working with the Smothers Brothers. And he was upset that I took off and he went back to Houston. His mother said he sat on the couch for 2 weeks and didn't say a word to anybody.
Aww.
And I went back home and then got a call from our managers. The Good Time Singers were in, which was a Randy Sparks group. They were in Miami. They were supposed to back up Tennessee Ernie Ford on a television show, which was live at the time. And they made a bomb threat getting on the plane and got locked up by the FBI. Wow. And so they didn't have this backup group. And George and Sid said, you got to get out there. You got to put a group together. And it's got to be done in 48 hours. And, you know, you got to find whoever you can find on the streets, but get this group in shape and get them ready for that.
That's fine. Okay.
So I got on the plane and I went to Nashville. When I got off the plane in Nashville, Mickey was standing at the bottom of the steps. And I was like, what are you doing here?
Kenny called me.
And I said, Kenny called you? And he says, yeah. And he said, you know what? If you stay, we're going to do this the wrong way. So we're going to go and get married right now. And I said, you're crazy. And he goes, I might be, but you know it's right, and I know it's right, and that's what we're going to do. And by 3 o'clock that afternoon, we were married. We had been in each other's company a total of 8 hours. My poor parents.
And people think BYU is bad.
Poor parents. Because I had been engaged 3 times to return missionaries. There were wonderful guys, but it just wasn't right. I was getting married for the wrong reason, because I loved their parents or my parents loved them, or, you know, it just wasn't right. And so we were married, and then I had to call my parents and tell them, bless their hearts. They were wonderful. But we were married 32 years
and had four kids.
Yep. And he joined the church. It took a while, but he joined the church about 10 years after we were married.
That's amazing.
Well, I have Mickey to thank. You gave me a collection of his music when I was working on my dissertation, and it was the soundtrack of my dissertation. So every time that I hear it,
you hear his music, you think about the dissertation.
That was your study, like your wife.
It was incredible music because he's so talented,
he's an incredible songwriter.
But I wasn't familiar with his music, so I could have it on while I was like reading or even while I was writing, and it wasn't too distracting, but it was really
enjoyable. The kind you kick back and sing along with, you know. It's very
so talented though.
It's very intuitive.
Yeah. So thank you.
I need to familiarize myself too, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That'll be my project this week.
He was amazing. Yeah. And right now there's over 2,000 covers of his songs.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Well, not the newer country people. I don't even know who they are in Nashville anymore. But back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. He was the songwriter other songwriters listened to.
Mm-hmm. So. As Mickey got sick, and you know, and then as he passed away, what role did the gospel play in that for you?
Oh,
and,
my gosh!
I mean, I'm sure that there was also some just survival with your kids and everything else that was going on in your life.
And the bishop being there for me, you know, mm-hmm. and just, you know, I remember the night that Mickey passed away. I didn't know what to do. I mean, what do you, because he had been sick for so long and we'd have had so many close calls, and I'd taken him on the motorhome and driven him, you know, all the way back to Houston and then all the way home, and he would go comatose and then he'd be fine. And we just never knew, you know, from day to day. And then one night he was just gone. And I remember nobody, you know, the doctor says, well, you don't need me anymore. Okay, well, who do I need? And Gene Drake in Fifth Ward, who, you know, was a mortician. I called Gene. I said, Gene, what do I do? He goes, I'll be right there. And he did. And he came and he took care of everything. And the bishop helped. And it was just, you know, the Ward family stepped up and helped the kids, helped me. It was amazing. So, and just the knowledge of knowing. Yeah, I hate that word, you lost your husband. No, I didn't. I don't lose him. Mm-hmm. I know exactly where he is. Right. I maybe don't know exactly what he's doing right now, but I know exactly where he is. And this sounds crazy to some people, but if I want to talk to him, I just go to the temple and sit there. Mm-hmm. It's instantaneous. Sometimes he's there, sometimes he's not. Mm. And when he's not there, I know, oh, he's busy someplace doing something. I'm not sure where. You know,
writing Mickey, songs you could never for somebody.
Tell. Well, Mickey was a risk taker too. People don't know that he was Special Forces in the Air Force. Wow. He was a radio operator, so he wasn't a gun toting, but Special Forces would go into, he went into Cambodia, he went into Thailand long before we were in Vietnam. He was in the Congo. He had things he couldn't tell me and I didn't want to know, you know. So who knows what he's doing? I don't know. Maybe That's he's awesome. Over in Israel right now.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing them.
But I love that you said that you go to the temple to be close to him, because I've always felt that that's where, if I'm going to be close to somebody who's passed on, that's where it's going to be. It's not going to be the cemetery.
No. In fact, we jokingly, we take the grandkids up to the cemetery and we eat Cheetos at the grave on his birthday every year.
Perfect.
Because he loved Cheetos. And, you know, it's just a good way to get the kids.
I've seen Laura's pictures of that.
Yeah. And that's what we do. But the temple is amazing because it's not, you can't stand there and have a face-to-face conversation with him. But, boy, you get answers, you know. Yeah. You go with questions. And if you sit quietly enough and long enough, they come.
Just a testament of that, the power of that sealing covenant.
Oh, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's strong, you know. And you don't have to say, oh, is that what he meant? Is that what he meant? No. You know what the answer is. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah. It's cool. Well, a great thing for our listeners, too. I know that's something we've tried to emphasize in our stake for a while, just the, you know, myriad blessings we can get from temple attendance. I'm going to lighten things up for a minute, just a minute, because I've got a live question.
Can I add one thing about the temple? Because I was one of those women, because Mickey was not a member, I would not go, you know, because in my generation, you just didn't go until you got married in the temple. Well, I had opted out of that by marrying a non-member, so I felt like I shouldn't go. I should wait for him. I should wait for him. And then I had an amazing bishop that said, no, you should not. If you want the blessings in your home, then you go now.
Right.
And so I had that conversation with Mickey.
The blessings of the priesthood in your home.
Yeah. And he was like, I have no problem with it. And I said, okay, well, I've been kind of a dummy, haven't I? And so I went ahead and went to the temple and took out my endowments. And the temple's not something you have to. You only qualify yourself for it, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not the Lord saying, oh, you're not worthy, you can't come. No, you go when you want to implement those blessings in your home. Then you make yourself temple worthy and you go. It's
right. The last question, right, is do you consider yourself worthy to attend the temple and pray?
So,
That's awesome.
Don't wait, go.
And I do love, particularly with the sisters, the new kind of emphasis on when you're 16 to start talking about going to the temple and having your endowment.
Right. Well, even just this last general conference, it was very clear. The only requirements are that you're 18 and you've graduated from high school and that you feel worthy and ready to go.
Yep.
And I love it.
I have some live questions here from Laura Hansen, your daughter. So
this is an ambush.
We'll go through a few, and then we'll get back.
Are these like rapid fire answers?
Yeah. Well, at first she says, "How do you feel about moss?"
About moss?
Yeah, M-O-T-H-S.
It's the only thing I'm afraid of on this planet. A moth.
A moth.
When I was growing up in Junction City, we used to we played outside all the time. And at night, we had this big light on the outside of the barn. And the moths would come to the light. I had very long hair. And they would get caught in my hair and fly in my face. And it just freaked me out. I hate moths. I honestly, it's the only creature on the planet I don't like. And one night, my 16-year-old son says, "Hey, Mom, come take a look at this." And I said, "What is it?" He says, "Just come look." And I went into his room. He says, "Look out the window." And I looked out the window and he started laughing hysterically. Mm. And I looked down in this laundry basket under the window has a gypsy moth with a wingspan of, it had to be 10 to 12 inches.
Oh, gosh.
And I thought I was going to pass out. And Chris was delighted.
Because he was delighted.
He had walked me into that.
That's great.
I have to admit, I'm with you on that. We did a high adventure trip.
They fly like they're drunk, you know?
And they're unpredictable.
So unpredictable, and they just freak me out.
Totally. Like, we had a high adventure trip a couple years ago, and we had this large campsite. Me and my son arrived a couple days early, and the park ranger came out, and he told us, you know, we had our own individual bathrooms, and he's like, "But I wouldn't go in there because the moths have taken over it." And I was like, "Does anybody, like, you know, remove the moths or anything?" And he's like, "I'm not going to do it. You guys can do it if you want."
Does anybody have a can of Raid?
Yeah, well, that's what we had to do. But, man, like, there were thousands of moths, like, in the area, and they're super creepy.
Yep.
And I wouldn't go to the bathroom with moths, like, all over the place.
I was gonna say, I feel like I've seen you deal with, like, spiders and snakes.
Well,
and
I used to do a unit with my sixth graders where they would have to take these worms, these larvae, and let them hatch into moths. And we did silkworms, you know, but I always had to just kind of bite my tongue and get through that because they would develop into moths.
Here's another. We'll save some more of these for later. We'll just randomly insert them. But she also says, "What really happened to the box turtle?"
Oh, that's mean. That's just mean.
What happened to the box turtle?
One of the things, as a teacher, you're always having these kids come up to you and say, "I have this animal and I can't have it anymore and I have to find a home for it."
No, not every teacher. But if they know Mrs. Oakley, then they're going to say, "Hey, Mrs. Oakley.
I wound up with a box turtle. I wound up with cats."
So or the Fuller's chicken when they stop laying eggs.
Turtle home. And it was great. He disappeared for the winter, so we knew he was hibernating. And then springtime came, and one day I pulled out of the driveway and I ran over the box turtle, and we heard the crunch, and it was very sad.
Oh, gosh.
Did Laura know the ending of this story?
She knew. She set me up totally because she was in the car when it happened. In fact, she's probably the one that screamed, "Mom, you ran over the box turtle."
I have another kind of fun question. Something you may not know about Susan is that she was Miss Oregon.
Oh.
And beauty pageants were kind of a big part. You kind of stayed connected to that community a little bit as you kind of helped. Over some years, then you also, like, were in, like, you placed in the Miss USA or Miss America.
In all fairness, before I ran for Miss Eugene, I had never watched a pageant. I was a tomboy. I played tackle football till I was 14 in the neighborhood. Seriously, I was not a girly girl. My mom was very glam. She had been she was from show business and come to this little town of Eugene. Was 25,000 when we moved here. And so she found ways, very little theater, University of Oregon, she found ways to do the glam thing. Yeah. But I was never really into that. I would perform because she'd set us, all of us kids, up to do that. But so they came through, the JCs came through at South Eugene and said, "Listen, we have a problem. We have this pageant and too many of the University of Oregon kids are winning it all the time. And the girls are not from Eugene. We keep having Miss Eugene not from Eugene." Hmm. "So we need to get more people into the pageant from Eugene." And that year, I think it was my senior year. And I had just been cast in Sound of Music, and my best friend turned to me and said, I'll do it. Will you do it? I said, sure, what the heck? Can't be that bad. And so I stepped into that, and then I won Miss Eugene, and then I won Miss Orion. And then you realize all these people that are behind you that have donated all these hours and are so invested in this, and you're like,
I just showed up.
Oh my gosh, I just showed up. I didn't expect this to go anywhere. You know, I mean, nobody was more surprised than I was, because that had never been my thing. And some of these girls, they'd been doing pageants since they were 3 years old. Right. Mm-hmm. So I wound up going to Atlantic City and placing in the top 10. I was number six. You know, and a lot of that was because they said, well, if you just listened to us, you would have, you know, placed higher. I said, yeah, but I wouldn't have won. We all knew it was going to win. So
what were the things that you didn't listen to?
Well, I went out, I did a thing from Sound of Music, and I was in a nun's habit, or not a nun's habit, a novitiate, a postulant's habit. Okay. Uh-huh. And the director at South Eugene, Ed Regazzino, was Catholic. He had choreographed it. He had made sure I performed it in front of the sisters at whatever the
St. Alice or St. Anne's.
Wherever it is over there in Springfield, there was a nunnery at the time.
Oh.
And they wanted to make sure that this was not going to offend people. And they said, no, it's fine. It's not a sister's outfit. It's a postulant. Because there was some crazy dancing, and it was just from Sound of Music. It wasn't a big deal. Well, when I got to Atlantic City, they said, no, 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 you can't do that on live TV. You'll offend a lot of Catholics. And I said, it was Catholic that choreographed it. You know. And they said, well, you have to just go out in a formal gown and sing. Well, there was another girl singing Climb Every Mountain from the same musical. Mm-hmm. And I said, her voice, there's no way that I'm not. It's not my vocal ability. It's my acting ability. And so they told me I had to change. And I said, no. So I was the hard one to deal with, and I went out and did it the way, you know, I'd done.
Right. Well, I can say it's one of the things that one of my biggest failures was when I was the principal, and my goal was when you retired to have a video of that pageant video. I believe that it exists somewhere. I never got my hands on it.
It's out there somewhere. CBS has it. I saw it once, but
I've never seen the actual video. Seen photography, of course, but I did find the movie that Susan was in called Swimsuit, and I do own
a swim team.
I have the DVD of it if anybody needs to borrow it.
It holds me hostage.
And it's pretty great.
What year was that you where did that?
The movie Swim Team?
No, Miss America.
Oh, I was 1965. I was Miss Oregon.
Yana's on it. She's going to find the video.
I am.
I was the youngest that year because you had to be 18. And I turned 18 in July and then went to Atlantic City in September.
Oh, wow. Yana's totally going to find this.
I'm excited about it. I'm so excited.
Good luck. It's really because they didn't, it was all live. Yeah. They didn't really, the only people that recorded anything then was the major studio, and that's all vaulted, and they don't release that stuff unless, you know.
We'll find a way in the vault.
Okay.
Whatever.
We'll make it happen.
We'll break in. That's fine.
How did you find your way into education?
Well, after in and out of classes, you know, I was raising my kids, and we had insurance through a performing agency that decided they didn't want to insure anymore. And we had four kids and no insurance. And Mickey was self-employed. And I said, this isn't going to work. If our kids have a broken arm, we're going to go bankrupt. You know, we can't do this. So I went back into law school, which is where I was headed to begin with. But after spending a term in law school and talking to other law students, I realized the divorce rate in law school was about 50%. And Mickey was on the road a lot. And I had kids at home. And this was not going to work. I could not stay in the law library until 11 o'clock every night. So I had to step back and say, okay, what am I going to do here? And about that time, Laura was born. And so then I had another baby, you know, that it was like, how am I going to juggle? Without my mother, it never would have happened. I mean, she was amazing. She stepped in and took over. But I decided, Mickey's idea was, he said, well, you know, if you go into teaching, then you've got the same hours as the kids. You've got summers off. You know, it's a little more manageable and there's pretty good benefits. And that way, you know, we don't have to worry about what you're making. It's the insurance we're after. So that's what I did. I'm back to the University of Oregon, sat through those classes as a mother going, they don't know what they're talking about. These people have no idea what they're talking about. They have never dealt with children. Okay. This is not going to work. And I think I had one professor in 3 years that made any sense at all, you know?
Yeah.
But finally graduated and then started subbing for 4 years and then took a full-time job.
I have a favorite quote that I came away from my education with. I graduated in marriage, family, and human development. And my favorite saying was from an author in child development. She said, what is it? Before having children, I had 6 theories on child development. Now I have 6 kids and 0 theories.
Because every one of them's different. Right. Yeah. Well, you know, as a young person, you sit in meetings and go, oh, my kids will never act like that, Sacramento. Yeah. They will behave. They will sit here quietly. That is never going to happen, you know. And then you have kids that go, oh, my gosh, where did I lose it all?
Right.
Well, tell me what you're learning about the refugee community. It's a bit of a jump.
The refugee community.
Well, you listed that as an issue that...
What is the most interesting thing you're
currently learning about?
Yeah, well, it's like I was fascinated by the Ramadan.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I'd been around for that. I don't know if anybody outsiders were invited or not, but I would have loved to have seen that.
Well, we'll host them again, so we'll make
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, and just the things that the Stake Relief Society is doing for the Afghan refugees and the church's stand on immigration. You know, we have to understand that the Lord has a lot of different ways to seed the clouds. Does that make any sense? You know, we think we've got it all locked down and we understand, and then all of a sudden something incredibly crazy happens. Like right now, the Lord knows the southern border is open, and I don't want to take a political stand one way or the other because I've seen both sides. You know, but look at the people that are flowing into this country that are now available to hear the gospel that maybe they couldn't before. And that fascinates me, how that whole thing turns around and you have a chance to start sharing. I know that my daughter, who lives in Heber City, their community is very involved in working with immigrants and resettlement and, you know, a serious taking on not just providing sanitary kits, but taking people into their home who are not members, you know, and they're learning the gospel that way. My very best friend, and it's funny, you know, I've known her for probably 40, almost 50 years now. She was from Guadalajara and she was 17 years old and she'd been married a year and she was 8 months pregnant with her child when they realized they could not stay in Guadalajara. If they stayed, they would have to work for the cartel. And so she swam the Rio Grande in November at night with 8 men in a cotton dress. Now, Texas, the Rio Grande in November is like the McKenzie in December. It's not warm. And she made it across that river. And then she was under the floor of a house for 2 weeks until her cousin showed up to pay the coyote the money for her to get out. She was 8 months pregnant. And she did this because she knew they could not stay where they were. And so to watch, you know, the whole transformation of her coming to the United States, finally, Mickey sponsored them during the Reagan administration. They got their citizenship. They had a very successful life in Houston. Her husband, who had been a cowboy and kind of headed the wrong direction, had a very incredible spiritual experience, turned his life around, and has become a Baptist youth minister in a tiny little congregation in Oneonta, Alabama. It's an incredible story. If you ever want to have somebody on your podcast, I mean, this couple is unbelievable. And Lee and I visited them this last month, and to look at how he has turned his life totally over to the Savior and has started 2 separate Hispanic congregations in this tiny little Alabama town.
Yeah.
And he's working with migrant people that have nothing. These are not the illegals that are coming over the border. These are the families who work the tomatoes and the wheat and the cotton. And they literally have nothing. And so Jesse's whole life is dedicated to trying to find, you know, supplies for them, sanitary supplies, diapers, food, clothing. What if he doesn't do it, nobody else does. And he says they live in these tiny little drafty shacks with no beds, you know, no furniture, hardly anything to cook on. And but they are just happy to be in the United States.
Wow.
So that's the fascination for me with immigration, is how the Lord can take something and turn it on its ear and go, oh, you think you got this all figured out? Well, look, now you got immigrants to deal with. Let's see how Christ-like you can be here.
Right.
Would you mind sharing with us a time when the Lord has brought about something very difficult in your life to get your attention and maybe brought about some vulnerability that's been difficult for you?
Oh, I would have to say Mickey's death. That, you know, sorry. Even to this day, the support that the Lord gave and the fact that I couldn't be angry. You know, we had 32 years, 5 great kids, and no matter where they are, they're wonderful human beings. Yeah. They have strong moral compasses. They live to serve other people. And I would have to say that that's probably the most difficult thing I've been through.
Thank you for sharing.
And I'm following up on that, if we could, because one of the questions we asked, what were you most proud of? And you mentioned, you know, your endurance. Yeah. I just, and we read through that before the show, and I was like, you know, when I hear that, it's somebody that's been through a lot of challenges and learned through it.
Well, you know, you just, as a teenager, you're not sure where you're going. You think you know, but then your path changes and there's more challenges and you're like, okay, wait, why me? But then you get through that and you think, okay, wait, I wouldn't trade that experience because now I have knowledge that I didn't have before. And a life just becomes that constant, are you going to give up or are you going to see it through? Well, look at the legacy I come from. You know, how can I give up when I've got 5 generations back that went through? I mean, I have that great-great-grandfather was hauled off into the woods by a mob, and his wife was told she would never see him again. And he told her, don't worry about it, I'm fine. And they threatened to shoot him. You know, this mob in Missouri, they were just going to do away with him. Satchel Woods said, you know, you're a Mormon, you're done. And he kept telling somebody else to shoot him, somebody else to shoot him. And my great-great-grandfather turned to him and said, you call yourself a man of God, and yet here you are willing to take my life. And nobody would shoot him. And they finally just slunk off into the woods. And my great-great-grandfather walked back to the wagon, got in it, and they left. I just, how can you give up when you've got people in your ancestry that have done things like that, you know? And then my own mother, you know, she was born into a family that her father had a lot of alcohol problems. Her mother left him. I had this kind of fairy tale idea that she'd grown up in the South. And then I got to reading her journal and realized she was never in the same place year after year. Her mother was kind of gypsy. Her mother would go in and start a business, sell it, move someplace else. And she, her whole, all the way through her high school years was like that. I thought, I didn't know that, you know, until I sat down and read her journal. And her journal wasn't really available till after she died. So it was like, oh my gosh, you think you know people and you really need to find out what their background is.
It's really interesting to me. You take great strength in the faithfulness of your ancestors and those who have gone before you. My patriarchal blessing counsels me to honor my family name. And the name Grossnickel for me is a difficult one. The men who have carried the name Grossnickel before me that I know, in my mind, have not brought honor to it spiritually. And when I study in the scriptures and I hear the words, remember the captivity of your fathers, I think about certain sins that I want to avoid or want to get out of or not repeat. And that can be, I can kind of spur me on to live better and live higher and holier and encourage me to be faithful in that way and trying to not repeat the sins of the past. But What kind of advice would you give to somebody like me who feels like I don't have that? In some areas, I do have a wonderful pioneer ancestry.
No, nobody's ancestors are perfect. Mm. That same great-great-grandfather was cussed out by Brigham Young in public and threatened to have his membership taken away because they had had a council of 50, and they, at that time, they were being very persecuted. And there was one particular person that they had decided what they were going to do if this person moved against them. And my grandfather opened his mouth and warned that person, not because he cared about the person, but because he was angry with the person and it was a threat. You know, it was like, but he broke that confidence and Brigham let him have it. I mean, in public, to where my great-great-grandfather was weeping on the street on his knees, begging Brigham for a second chance. He also, in the records, the council had to not sanction, but advise him about selling whiskey. He didn't drink the whiskey, but he sold it to non-members because John was one of those men that he never lived in the middle of where the saints were. It was always out at Adamondiaman or downriver.
Outskirts.
Or, you know, he drove wagons. He found ways to make money. He was into the security of, you know, if the prophet says we're going to do this, we're going to do this. He says, get two oxen. No, get four oxen. If he says, get two wagons, get six wagons, you know, that's what John did. And so there was some pride involved there too. And he was criticized by other members that he wouldn't share. He turned on them and said, hey, you were told to get ready just like I was. You're on your own kind of thing. So even when you have a legacy like that, it's not perfect. It's, you know, we're all human. We all have our quirks, and we have to learn to get over those things, you know, with the Lord. But it's amazing to go back and look at how, even though they were imperfect, they still strove to live a very good life. Mm. And I can't imagine seven wives and seven farms. That poor man.
Oh,
I mean, seriously. Two of the women were sisters and lived together in Salt Lake, so he didn't have to farm for them. But there was a farm in Bountiful, there was a farm in Camas, there were farms all over.
That's incredible.
And he just had to get in the buggy and go from farm to farm to farm, week to week to week. And went on a lot of missions, and now I know why. You know, I mean, he left sons in charge, you know. But
I love that. I got called on another mission.
He went with John Taylor to open the French mission. They were the first missionaries there to the Channel Islands. And he was also, he was with, I don't remember who he was with, but he was in Pennsylvania stumping for or trying to find out if Joseph could be president. They were kind of on a mission, but they were trying to find out if Joseph should run for president when the prophet was killed. Mm-hmm. And for years he and Orrin Porter Rockwell were very close, and they were kind of like the designated bodyguards of Joseph. You know, they were always trying to keep Joseph safe because I think they didn't really believe the Lord would do it. You know, John ran the red brick store for Joseph for a couple of years. And then after Joseph died, they moved him a kitty corner. They bought a tavern across the street, and they didn't want enemies of the church in that tavern. So they moved John over there to run that tavern so they could keep an eye on that. So, you know, he wasn't perfect, but he was always in the thick of things and always trying.
What I love is just thinking about some of your grandchildren that I also know that are going to be telling stories about you, you know, that maybe some of the same things, you know, like she wasn't perfect, but like, look at all these faith-filled stories. Look at these things that we learned from her. And one of the things that I loved in the time that we had working together, I loved having conversations with you just about our kids and parenting. You're kind of a step ahead of me. And so you have had a lot of wisdom to share with me, I think, as we kind of struggle through that. But what are some things that you have learned as a parent or continuing to learn about parenting?
Oh, well,
as you keep just moving
through
life?
To love them. It's Christ's job to save them, not yours.
Mm.
It's your job to love them. And however, everybody's journey is individual, and everybody has to figure that out for themselves. As much as we would like to make it perfect and easy for them, that's not up to us. And they make decisions that you go, What did I do? Oh my gosh, I'm a terrible parent. And then the Lord goes, no, you're not. They're my child first.
Yeah, right.
You know, get in line.
Yeah.
So it's, that's, you know, you have to step back and go, I'm part of the plan.
Right.
The plan is perfect, whether I can see it or not. Mm-hmm. It is a perfect plan and it's all going to come out okay. And you have, the older I get, the more faith I have to have. Because I see the world going crazy. It's like last night on the news,
Just keeps coming.
Is this going to be the end of the world? No.
Yeah.
Just be still and know that I am God. I'm in charge. It's going to be okay.
It's a great
talk. It's going to get wild.
Yeah.
There's going to be a roller coaster ride. And, you know, when the saints moved west, people lost hands and feet and people died and things happened and rattlesnakes bit people and kids got lost. And that's, it happens, but it's part of the plan, and we just have to live with it.
Yeah, I love that answer that you gave about it's Christ's jobs to save and our job to love. That's very profound. It's something, it reminds me of...
That's not for me. Rinlin ended his talk last conference with
me. Yep, I remember.
My Relief Society lesson today, that was the closing statement in his talk. It's Christ's job to save, it's yours to love.
Warner Mitchell in Second Word, I've had several conversations with him about things like this too, and he said that too. I think one of his sons shared something. I think his son that plays Joseph Smith in all the videos once kind of shared, you know, like when in the next life, when we're there, you know, in the judgment seat or whatever, I think the only question is going to be, did you love them like I do?
Yeah.
Right. That's
how
all that we
help?
Can do.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And I think honestly, a child, it's showing them love in the first place is important for you. But I think somebody who knows that they're loved knows their value. And I think somebody that knows their value and respects themselves is more set up to succeed in this life and next too.
Well, and we have to look at the generation that's coming through. There are a lot of people leaving the church, okay? Mm-hmm. Cloud seeding. The Lord's going to use them for something. The Lord doesn't give up. He doesn't let it go that easily. They're his children first. He will find a way for them to be useful, you know, and we have to trust in that because, yeah, it'd be great if they just all lived that perfect little life and went to BYU and got married in the temple and had six kids that all went, but that's not the way life goes. Life gets sticky and it gets complicated and we just have to trust.
Yeah.
But there's joy in the stick, too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Should we do another random Laura question?
Oh, sure.
Go for it.
Let's see. She said that she would love if you could give us tips on washing your hair in the wilderness.
Well, first of all, Susan's hair always looks impeccable,
it's
right?
It's true.
Yeah.
We went hunting one year. We went up to the middle sister, to Linton Meadows. And I don't know why it even occurred to me to have to wash my hair while we were up there. We were up there like 4 or 5 days. And there was this creek, and there were bears on the other side of the creek. We'd seen this mother bear and her cubs, you know, a couple times. And so I took this bowl of water and dumped it over my head and screamed so loud. I think I had a headache for 3 hours. I had never had water that cold before. You know, and Laura remembers because she was like 10 years old, I think.
Well, now there are people that pay a lot of money for that experience.
I guess, yeah.
the cold plunge, yeah.
The cold plunge sitting in ice water.
Yeah.
Whatever that's about.
No, I definitely do it, but it's because I'm a sucker. So I'll try anything like that.
Speaking of being in the woods, so you've taught two of my daughters. You have one of them now, and you've had my other. She didn't want me to say her name, but it is your name also.
Yes.
In class, and she asked, you taught her them survival skills. You taught them how to start fires at school. And
she's looking at me. Like,
where the principal was aware of this.
It was with his full approval.
Absolutely.
We just forgot to ask the district downtown if it was okay.
No, we didn't forget. That was a choice.
They kept driving by going, why is there all that wood out there? What is going on?
That was a strategic choice, not to ask the district.
It was a strategic choice, yeah. Sometimes it's just better to ask forgiveness.
Yeah. She remembers your classes very fondly, and she wanted to know, where did you learn those skills, and have you ever had to use them?
Survival.
Oh, yeah. Camping. The woods. I love the woods. So have to use them. Have is probably not the right word.
To use them.
Chance to use them. Yeah. I can say that a lot of those skills came from girls' camp growing up. Hmm. Girls' camp in my day was not what girls' camp is today. It's very hard for me to go be a leader at girls' camp today because it's pretty cushy.
Well, that's why we had you up last year to teach those
and
fire
that's
skills.
Not, you know, when we had girls' camp, we had no cabins. Mm-hmm. We had no tents. We had tarps on the ground and sleeping bags, and we had bears that roamed around. It was usually at, it was either at Scott Lake or it was down in Diamond Lake. But it was phenomenal. I mean, I'm sure testimony meetings are just as strong now as they were then. But those skills were, they taught them to us in girls' camp years ago. You know, that's back in the 50s and 60s.
Did those skills come in handy this last winter during the ice storm?
Yes, because we have a wood stove. And you know what? I got to build every fire we have. Well, actually, I started a fire on the 15th and it didn't go out until 2 weeks later.
There you go.
I kept it going because it was cold. It was really cold. That was, you know.
Yeah. Kind of along those lines, I got the pleasure of watching you teach for several years, and it's hard to even think about you doing, I don't know if I ever saw you do like a full curriculum back to back, like the same thing from year to year. You're always changing things up and learning something new.
That's my ADD side.
But I think it also exemplifies just the love you have for learning, and you're constantly, you know, open-minded and learning new things.
I love teaching because I love learning new things. There's nothing more exciting than having a kid raise their hand and tell me something I don't know. It's amazing. Yeah. The survival thing came about because after COVID, the kids were really fearful, all of them, you know, and we would ask them questions, or I think I did a survey one day and they wrote down that their biggest fear was that they were going to die in World War III. And I was like, this is not okay. These kids, you know, they should not be worrying about those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And so when we got specific, it was like, well, what are we going to eat? You know, how are we going to live? And so I thought, well, you know what? We'll just do survival skills and show them that you can go out there. And there's a lot in Oregon. There's a lot to eat. Mm-hmm. If you know what to eat, there are some dangerous things too. So I had Ross Penhaligon.
I was going to say, shout out to Brother Penhaligon.
Yeah, Brother Penhaligon came and he did, bless his heart, he did every class for 2 days and took them out and showed them exactly what they could eat and how they could fry it or how they could prepare it. And then I had another one of our teachers, her partner is a catering chef, and she came in and showed them how they could fry up worms and crickets. Yeah. And maybe that's not your choice.
They were pretty good.
But they, even the kids that didn't want to try, did try and then asked for seconds. Yeah. So, you know. How to eat fried worms. And so it's just a matter of knowledge, you know, when you have that, whether you have to use it or not, it brings a sense of comfort. And the eighth graders were learning to build shelters. You know, here's a tarp. How are you going to keep yourself dry and warm? You know, and they really enjoyed it. And the fire building thing with seventh graders, how can you mess with fire? I mean, you can't, you know, here's how you start a fire with a magnifying glass. Here's how you start a fire with a battery. Here's how you start a fire, you know, it was amazing. But I made them chop their own wood too.
And they didn't start building fires in other classrooms. So
no,
I was
didn't.
Appreciative of that.
Which that had happened at Thurston in sixth grade. We had two boys building fires in the back of the room with rubber cement. So
with
but, you know,
rubber
it wasn't
cement.
A new thing.
I just like to smell rubber
that
cement.
Never that, changes. So good.
That sounds, never changes.
No. Sounds like you've got a cooking business going now.
We have some eighth grade boys that are cooking. And it's, well, this time when I went in, there was one class where there's supposed to be seven kids in the class and one child was coming. And I was like, this isn't okay. You know, what's going on? So I sat him down and I said, okay, here's the deal. We're going to start a business and you're going to have to do a business plan, come up with a name, a budget, and you're going to cook for the staff and they're going to donate. Food's going to be free for them, but you're going to donate. They're going to donate. And whatever money you make at the end of the year, you're going to split. Two ways, four ways, whoever shows up.
This is what the ELD kids, the English
the
language
ELD kids. And now we have every single one of them coming, except for one who we think is going back to Mexico, but we're not sure. Awesome. And those, they have not missed a day because they have something to do. They're engaged. It means something to them. They're learning new skills. They've already They've fried up taquitos. They've made cookies. They're, you know, it's things that they can do. They know they can do. They've just not had the opportunity.
I'm at the wrong school.
Yeah. I know. I can't tell you how many times a plate of goodies would end up on my desk at work. And
so they've got next Thursday, they're doing taquitos for all the staff lunches. And then they're doing a taco bar the Thursday before Cinco de Mayo, which is hilariously not a holiday they're interested in at all.
Right.
Cinco de Mayo is a totally gringo holiday.
They don't celebrate it in Mexico.
It's kind of like St. Patrick's Day in Ireland. They go, what?
We just like an excuse to eat tacos,
right. So they're going to take advantage of that. And then they're going to do, one of the boys is Filipino. So they're going to do adobo chicken and rice.
Oh, cool.
Thursday. And then
let me know what Thursday that is.
I'll let you know. Well, right now they're messing with their
curriculum that day.
And then they're going to do a car wash, which in the past.
Let me know when that is too.
when we did, it's right after the Memorial Day, because teachers come back with their cars all messed up after the Memorial Day. They don't have time to clean them up till the next weekend. So, you know, they will spend $5 to have those kids vacuum out the car and wash it down. And then the last Thursday that they're cooking, they're doing pulled pork and desserts. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. I can see that they could wind up with $400 or $500.
That's amazing.
And
that's
dividing that among five or six kids is, you know, they're in.
Yeah, that's awesome.
They're like, okay, this is, you know, capitalism at its great.
It's a lot of trips to Dutch Bros.
Well, not many. Dutch Brothers is expensive.
Fewer than you'd hope, though.
Right. Yeah.
I wanted to hear about meeting President Kimball in the Seattle Temple.
Yeah, she shared this story with us in Relief Society today. It's great.
When the Seattle Temple was, when a temple's dedicated, they have several dedicatory choirs because they have several sessions. And the Eugene, Oregon State provided a choir for one of the sessions. And a good friend of mine, Marty Condi, and I were asked to be in the choir, which was amazing. And so we went up to the dedication and they put you in the celestial room and you're really packed in there tight. I mean, the chairs are really close together and really tight in front of you. So we file in the celestial room and we're sitting there and everybody's filling the seats and Marty and I are talking and we look and we realize that the four seats in front of us are empty. And I was like, who's going to sit there? She goes, I don't know. Maybe the temple president. So we sit there and in walks President Kimball and his wife, Camilla, and they sit right in front of us. And it's so close that my mouth, which I'm supposed to be singing, is not 6 inches from the back of his head.
Right.
And I thought, I can't do this. I can't. Marty, I can't sing. She'll be fine. I said, I can't do this. She said, yes, she'll be fine. She's everybody crying anyway. So and that's basically what happens because the spirit's so strong. So we went ahead and we sang and he didn't put his hands over his ears. So it's okay.
That's nice.
And then he left the room. They left the room and then the choir files out. Well, if you're in the hallway and the prophet is walking the hallways, they clear the hallways. His security just, you know, clear the hallway, the prophet's coming. And you just back into whatever room is right there, which most of the time it's an endowment room or, you know,
ceiling room. Or something.
And so we backed into a ceiling room and there's so many people in there that Marty and I were like right there in front of the door and you couldn't go back any farther. And we just waited and we expected to see President Kimball walk by. He walks right into the room and stands right in front of us. And my first thought is, why is he all lit up? He has a light inside of him. It's like glow sticks. What? And I look down to see if his feet are touching the floor because in my mind, it's like he's levitating. You know, he was just filled with light. That's the only description I can give of it. He was translucent. And he thanked us all for being in the choir and for singing at the dedication. And then he said, and the spirit has just touched me. So today I'm going to go home and repent.
Awesome.
And you kind of go, the prophet has to go repent. Oh, where am I on that ladder? And then he shook Marty's hand and I thought she was going to faint and he walked out.
Yeah, that's awesome. Wow.
It was incredible. A very sweet, kind man, you know, but seriously filled with light, like he was a jack-o'-lantern, like there was light coming from inside him. It was really cool.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your answer here about the role that being a member of the Church of Jesus Christ has played in your life and developing a relationship with Christ. And you answered developing gratitude. What role has gratitude played in your life, and how is that connected to the Savior for you?
I think the biggest thing is that as I worked with, well, you know, 32 years in education and then 20 some years before that in the music business, when you work with people that don't have Christ in their life and you see the problems that they encounter and how they're at a loss mm-hmm. to have any tools to solve those problems, you become so grateful that you have that inside information. You know, it's like, I don't like surprises. I never have. I don't like surprise parties. I don't like surprise gifts. I like to know, you know, I don't like the unknown. I like to know. And I know that Heavenly Father knows me well enough to know that she had to go to maybe it wasn't the best gospel family, the strongest, but it had to be one where she could have the gospel, because otherwise she's going to be really ticked at me and, you know, don't mm-hmm. want to deal with that. So he put me in a position where my mother was not a member when I was born. In fact, one of my strongest core memories is of her in a farm pond in Colton at some friend's house, her walking into this farm pond with ducks swimming around her and the missionaries walking in behind her. I was 4 years old and watching her be baptized. Oh, and that's just such a strong core memory, mm-hmm. you know? And then, like most converts, you know, my dad had been a member all his life, but not, he was the Sunday school president, which back in those days meant this is the person, they need a job. It's an easy job. Let's, you know, dad was a wonderful man, but he was not zealous about, you know, we always went to church. Mm-hmm. He paid his tithing. You know, things were good. I have vague recollections of him smoking and then giving up cigarette, you know, and then not smoking. But my mother became the one full of zeal, and she made sure that, you know, we went to, it was MIA in those days, or we walked to primary on Wednesday afternoon, you know, and she was the guiding force for years, you know. So the gratitude comes from the fact that, oh, I could have been born to a family that didn't have a clue. Mm-hmm. And how awful that would be to not know. I don't know how people get through life mm-hmm. not knowing about their relationship with Christ, that they're a son and daughter of God, and what's available to them if they'll just step forward and take it. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, and then gratitude for my own family, for my kids, for their personalities. They're all totally different. Mm-hmm. None of them comes with a manual. Yeah. You know, it's like, it's amazing. You think this child, well, it's a boy. I've had a boy. This boy's going to be, no, not at all. Nothing at all alike. The two girls, that very close, but they're really not alike.
Yeah.
And learning to deal with, I mean, I shared a Relief Society today. I think my relationship with the Holy Ghost was the strongest once I had teenage kids. And I realized the Holy Ghost can't lie to me. Mm-hmm. Can't lie to me. So if I ask a very specific question, it's going to be, yes, that's true, or no, that's not, or there will be no answer at all because it's none of my business at this point in time. But as a parent, you know, if you ask the question the right way yeah. and you're seeking to help the child, then the Holy Ghost will answer honestly. And you're like, oh, that's a thought I didn't have before. I didn't think about doing it that way. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to try that. So, you know, that's where gratitude comes from.
I thought this was a cool subject to dive into a little bit more. I even when you were talking about being grateful for children, grateful for family, that's something that I really honed into. I was just thinking gratitude really can drive connection. Because a grateful parent has more natural connection with their children. Somebody who is grateful has more natural connection with their community. And it is a deliberate choice. I like it when the secular intersects with our beliefs. And I think this is a case where it totally does. I was looking over some articles just getting ready for today. And, you know, as a medical doctor, that's like something I enjoy, I guess, a weird that way, but you know, there's plenty of studies actually that show that gratitude practice leads to decreased depression and anxiety. But interestingly, even really measurable health outcomes like blood pressure, heart disease risk, all decrease when we express gratitude. It's just pretty neat. I like it when you can see that intersection where we can really sell people too that a lot of the things that we're doing, it's not just the spiritual that we really, you know, that's important to us. We're living a way of life that's good for us. I wanted to ask the group, what ways do you guys find to express gratitude?
Service, serving other people, you know, finding a way to help. Sometimes it's not a very big deal, but it's just acknowledgement, you know, just, I see you're going through a hard time, and that's all it takes. They just need to know somebody else is listening, is caring.
Mm-hmm. I do this with my students. We see a lot of kids, you know, have not the best home life, and you see a lot of complaining and a lot of like, my life is terrible and this and that. And we've started like every day saying, okay, we changed the question a little bit, but it's the same idea. Like, okay, what are you grateful for? Or who do you love and appreciate? Or right now we're talking, what makes you happy? Like what can make you happy today when you're sad? And making them look for those things in their lives so that they can kind of have that attitude of gratitude that can make a person happier. And you can see it when they're like, oh, it's the nurse's person. And they love it when they're like, it's Mrs. G. And yay. And they see that I'm happy because they're grateful for me and they're happy. And it's just so fun to see them like really think about it and think of something that they really are grateful for and love and the change in their countenance.
And just giving them an opportunity to express that.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them in their homes cannot.
Right.
If they were to tell their mom or dad they're grateful for them, they would be weird. Parents would back off and say, that's not normal.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate, but it's true.
I think that idea of just even directly expressing gratitude, I think that oftentimes we don't do that enough, even in our own families or in our jobs and, you know, our callings and all aspects of our lives, just being more open to actually express it. I think that there's a lot of power in like a handwritten note. I know that's like an old school.
True. That they're, you know, it's getting the kids to express on a piece of paper or card and sharing it with somebody not only benefits the person they've given it to, but benefits them because they've gone through that whole physical process of creating something that's positive for somebody else.
Well, and I even have like a few like in my desk drawer of just like notes that people have given me that like, you know, there's just moments sometimes where you need to give them out, get them out and just think, all right, you know, I'm not a terrible person. You know, there's some people that are thankful for me or, you know, there's...
The week I retired, the district did basically nothing. I got a framed certificate. Okay. I got a great email from you, got a great email from EJ, but the very best was a letter I got from a student saying, I wish you were coming back next year.
Right. Yeah. That's sweet.
I think even when you deliberately express gratitude at random times, it's really helpful. Like I just got a text I was reading from somebody in our ward. It was like, I just wanted to say I appreciate you for being bishop as a calling nobody wants, but you're willing to do it. And it was a day where I was like, I had a couple of whoopsies where I might have like forgotten to do something exactly by the handbook. And I was like kind of hating on myself and just getting that text is like, they probably don't know how much of a pick me up that is.
Right.
You know,
that's small.
Again, one of my gratitude activities lately is, I think for a long time has been to share things that I really enjoy with others. And Bishop Keister, I think you asked me previously one thing that I really enjoy about photography and why do I do it or how it helps me see things differently. And part of it for me is that if I see something that I feel is really beautiful or if I have to hike a long ways to get to a certain spot to see this incredible view, I want to try to capture it and to share it with others who weren't able to make that hike and weren't able to have that view or, you know, sometimes even go up and do a midnight start so we can see sunrise or something like you and I have done.
Well,
together.
One of us did. One of us was asleep on a rock.
Which one is which?
Love that comfy rock. Yeah. But, and then just the exercise of almost continual prayer. And this last couple of weeks, I've been working on a project that's taken a lot more time than I've thought. It's been a lot more physically and mentally challenging. And I've prayed for guidance so much more than I usually do. And I have to remember that, you know, if I pray for help on something and I get that help, or I learn a new skill, or even if it doesn't work out, and I ask the question, you know, what did I learn? How can I grow because of the way this worked out or it didn't work out? I need to express gratitude for that. And expressing that gratitude has helped me to grow. And oftentimes, if I pray on a Tuesday and it doesn't work out the way I think it does, and then on Friday I learn, oh, that was, I'm working on a long car project. That was the part for the left side, and I'm trying to install it on the right side. Or I, you know, that one part on the rear suspension is just not going right, and I've struggled with that for days, and I can't get this nut loose, and this bolt's frozen, and I've discovered that the axle is not rotating the way it should, and it's got a little joint that's not working properly, and so I've needed to replace that, and I wouldn't see it until I get to Friday, and so it's time to stop and say, "Oh, Heavenly Father, I thank Thee. I give Thee thanks. You know that I've struggled with this long enough to be able to see this problem that really needed to be fixed, and it took me 3 days, but I'm grateful for that time, and I could uncover this problem and really get this issue fixed now." And try to express the gratitude throughout the process, and try to express as much gratitude as I do ask for help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Good. Great. Does anybody else have any questions? We're at the time where we usually stop the podcast, but.
Oh, I'd like to sneak one in.
Yeah.
Sure.
What is a funny trick you've played on Jim?
Does he think they're funny, or do you think they're funny?
I don't play tricks on Jim. Okay. Not a trickster. Well, yeah, I'm not. I'm seriously, that's one of the backs. Never has been one of my strengths. Playing pranks or fooling people
She's a Susan. Yeah.
You know, and maybe that's a failing, but I just don't.
That's not a failing.
I just don't do that. I don't set people up like that. So.
We have a daughter whose name begins with S, who's very much the same way.
Very much.
Very independent.
I don't know. It's just, I'm sure there's one, but I can't.
he's going to be listening to this and think.
Yeah. I can't think of what it would be.
With your independent nature, I wanted to ask you, what is a way that you've come to rely on and appreciate Jim that's been unexpected?
Well, I'm not sure unexpected, because when Mickey passed away, I really had resolved never to remarry. I mean, that, you know, but I think that's probably everybody's first reaction.
You hear that.
But then I had teenage boys, and these teenage boys were really concerned about Mom and who was going to be with Mom on Friday, and are you going to stay home this weekend, or am I going to stay? You know, and I saw this going on. I'm like, this is not normal. This is not okay. I do not need to be taken care of, but they think I do, you know. So I thought, okay, I need to take a look at this again. Well, because Mickey had not been a real active member throughout their life, one of the things I had decided was that if I did remarry, it had to be somebody I was not going to have confrontation with about the gospel. Just, you know, I was willing to forego a lot of other expectations, but that was one I was going to draw the line about.
So you're saying Jim just doesn't meet your expectations in a lot of ways.
Oh, no. But... see, you're a prankster. No, Jim meets my expectations in a lot of ways. And the best part is that he is so committed to the gospel. Mm-hmm. He's a convert. And although he was a person of faith as a young person, he did not find the gospel until he was, you know, married and living in Wyoming. And his first wife was thinking about reactivating. And so she got in touch with her bishop, and the bishop had them over for dinner and had missionaries at the dinner. for who knows what reason. And so Jim, that's where Jim got taught the gospel. Mm. He's been through a lot of very adverse situations, none of which I will go into. But, you know, the fact that he had children who had made some of those same basic decisions about the gospel that I did, I knew that that was not going to be a source of friction. We were going to be able to support each other in that. And the fact that he's so committed to the church and to serving that it was easy to say yes, because he is a wonderful, loving person, you know. Absolutely. And that, so he meets those expectations.
It's great. Our youngest, who you are currently teaching, had the question, who is your favorite person to sing with?
Mickey.
Mickey.
My husband, yes. Although we didn't, you know, we did some studio work together. At that time, everybody was singing with their significant other. You know, John and June were singing together, and Chris and Rita were singing together, and Waylon.
I just want to pause, and like, she's just throwing around these names of people, right? Like, I love it. It's one of my favorite things.
Everybody had their little significant duo, you know, and it was becoming a thing. And I remember sitting at breakfast one morning, and Mickey looked at me and he said, I guess we ought to get some songs together, you know, and work something up. And I looked at him, I said, are you crazy? I said, I'm not going on stage with you. There's no way. And he said, why not? And I said, because you are your own thing, your own entity. And I'm not, I just want to be a mom. The singing thing was fun. It got me where I wanted to go. It made good money. It put me through college, you know, but I am not, never ever have I wanted to be on stage as a star. And so you're on your own here, because, and the look of relief on his face was monumental, because he thought he was cornered. And I was like, no, you know, you do too well on your own. I am not. We did sing together in a couple of places, but not, and it was the most fun because I knew his song so well. And, you know.
Well, going back to that idea of
Laura would be the second. Laura would be the second.
That would be great, yeah.
Singing with Laura, the national anthem with Laura has always been a highlight.
Yeah, you both have incredible voices. Going back to expressing gratitude, one of my favorite expressions of gratitude I've received is from Susan. We ended up working at Agnes our last day together. It was her last day before she kind of retired, and I was back. It was my last day there too, and she sang a song for EJ and I that Mickey had written called Brothers.
Brother Peter,
yeah.
Brother Peter.
But it was such a sweet expression. And, you know, as we kind of close this podcast, I just want to thank you for the person that you are and our relationship, the things that I've learned from you.
You were the best principal I ever worked with.
It's been just a blessing to have you in my life as well, the things that I've learned from you, both secularly and spiritually. And you're just someone that,
you knew
that I love and admire. So thank you for all that you do for so many.
Cool. That's a good point to end on. We always end with the same question.
Okay.
And we'll revise it a little bit here, but I want you to talk about what your connection with the Savior Jesus Christ is like.
Oh, good heavens. He's everything. I mean, he's the way, the light, the life. We're not going to get home without him. But even if that wasn't true, how could you choose not to live the way he lived, you know, the way he loved, the way he cared, the way he sacrificed? He is the ultimate example for all of us. And so the bumper stickers that bother me are the honk if you love Jesus, because that's not my relationship with him at all. He is my brother, but he is also my Savior.
Thank you again for connecting with us on this episode of our podcast. We hope you enjoyed the interview with Susie Oakley, and we look forward to doing more soon. And we might be able to do more regularly now that we actually have our episodes being edited by AI. So I'm curious to see what you guys think of this. This episode was actually purely edited by AI, taking out the pause words, unnecessary pauses in our dialogue, and any other errors in the recording that needed to be taken out. So I'm curious what you guys think. I think it'll help us speed up our turnover time on our episodes, and we'll be able to get some more interviews done with people in the stake and beyond pretty soon. Till then, thank you for subscribing. Thank you for listening. We couldn't do this without you guys, obviously. Till next time, take care.